Does acupuncture help for migraines?
If you have a pacemaker or defibrillator, can you have an MRI?
Stem cell transplantation and multiple sclerosis.
And testosterone and male aging.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on March 3rd, 2017, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think we should turn right to aging males. This ongoing controversy relative to testosterone supplementation, gosh, it's in the Journal of the American Medical Association, also rather extensively covered in JAMA Internal Medicine.
So Elizabeth, you had a smile on your face when you said you wanted to first talk to aging males, and I guess that was directed specifically towards me. So I'll take the challenge there. This is one of seven trials looking at the use of testosterone to really address many of the issues that aging males face. Not that I would face them, but of course I may in the future. And these are centered around the fact that over the last decade, there's really been a lot of hype about what's called low T, low testosterone, and treating it. This is a physiologic decrease in testosterone. And these seven studies addressed, does testosterone affect or does it help sexual function, physical function, vitality, cognition, anemia, bone health, seven different clinical endpoints. And in this edition of JAMA, there were two studies that looked at cognition and cardiovascular health. I'll try to summarize these just so we don't go into too much of the specifics. The one that looked at cognition took almost 500 men that had low testosterone and already had some age-associated memory impairment at baseline. So they did specific cognitive functioning at 6 months, 12 months, and treated these individuals either with testosterone or placebo with the hope that testosterone would help to delay the progression of the ongoing impairment of the cognition. Unfortunately, what it discovered was there was really no benefit at all. It did not change cognition in a positive manner. The second study had to do with cardiovascular disease, where they took 138 men with low testosterone, randomized either testosterone or placebo, and they had CAT scan, a CT scan of the heart, conducted at baseline and 1 year later, with the hope that testosterone would help delay the progression of plaque in the coronary arteries. Unfortunately, what happened was plaque was actually accelerated in those that took testosterone. So not only was it not helpful, it was in fact harmful. Now, this is a surrogate measure, but other studies have suggested that the administration of testosterone can actually accelerate cardiovascular disease and heart attacks. So this may be the physiologic explanation for that particular observation.
I think that the bulk of evidence is really suggesting that not only isn't there any benefit to these things, but there's really the potential for significant harm. I frankly can't understand why people keep turning toward them.
Well, again, there is a very modest benefit, a modest improvement in sexual dysfunction, a modest improvement if someone has anemia, and a modest improvement in bone health. But that's not worth the risk, as far as I'm concerned, of having increased cardiovascular disease and heart attacks. So, Elizabeth, I tend to agree. I think the data to date suggest that people with low T really don't have a substantial benefit from receiving testosterone therapy.
I guess unless it's really, really, really low, right?
The physiologic low testosterone, no benefit. The pathologic, where there's hypogonadism, that's an entirely different process. But we're talking about physiologic aging, and testosterone doesn't seem to rejuvenate the aging male.
Okay. Why don't we go now to JAMA Internal Medicine, a look at something that was hoped to be fairly promising and looks like it could be a little bit promising. That's the use of acupuncture for migraines.
And for individuals in China and some places in the Western world, acupuncture has been applied particularly to individuals that have migraine that seems to be resistant to routine medical therapy. Now, the acupuncture can be applied either to relieve the ongoing migraine or to prevent future migraines. And that was the source of this study. They asked the question, if we administered acupuncture therapy, combined with electrostimulation, by the way, and compared it to either sham acupuncture or placebo, did it reduce future migraines? Was it effective as prophylactic therapy? So this was a 24-week randomized controlled trial, 4 weeks of treatment, followed by 20 weeks of follow-up, in 249 participants randomized again to acupuncture with electrostimulation, sham acupuncture, or control. And what they discovered was that the patients who received the true acupuncture did have a decrease in the frequency of attacks and the number of days in which they suffered from migraines. It was fairly modest. Secondly, it's very difficult to have a control. because the individuals actually know who's treated. You say, what about the sham? Well, the actual acupuncture was applied to areas in which there was tenderness. So they palpated, they could identify specific areas, and the sham was not. So even that's not really a good control. So is it beneficial? Well, it's not harmful, so it can be tried. The other thing about this particular therapy was it was pretty intensive. It was 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week for 4 weeks. It's fairly expensive as well.
Maybe a trial of acupuncture in conjunction with traditional medical therapy would be something that might be helpful.
Elizabeth, that's an important issue because in this particular therapy, they did not allow the people to take prophylactic medication. So this was a therapy without any underlying medical therapy or pharmacologic therapy. So I agree with you. Combining the two may be more beneficial than either alone.
Okay. Speaking of things that are somewhat beneficial then, let's turn to JAMA Neurology. For folks with multiple sclerosis, stem cell transplantation and whether that really helps.
For individuals that have multiple sclerosis, there are obviously many different forms. One of the most disconcerting is what's called relapsing remitting, where the symptoms wax and wane. Oftentimes, when they occur, they get progressively worse, and it's indicative of an ongoing inflammatory process. For individuals that haven't responded well to medical therapy, are there other therapies that can be beneficial? One particular therapy that has been applied to people that have either cancer or other types of autoimmune disease are stem cell transplantation. These investigators looked at the long-term outcomes after stem cell transplantation. It was a large trial. It was retrospective. This was data obtained from 25 different centers in 13 countries. Almost 300 patients had been followed up an average of 6.6 years. There were about 8 deaths, that is 2.8% of individuals succumbed as a result of the stem cell transplantation. Of those who survived the therapy, about half had what was called progression-free survival at the end of 6.6 years. The overall survival rate was 93%, but half of those individuals had no progression of their multiple sclerosis. They did a little bit more digging and they said, are there individuals that are more likely to respond? Which is helpful because you want to select the patients that are most likely to respond. They were younger patients, those that had the relapsing form of multiple sclerosis, and those that have fewer prior immunotherapies, as opposed to those that were older, had had multiple therapies, and did not have the relapsing form.
Suggests to me, at least, that a trial or attempting to use this therapy earlier in the course of the disease is probably a good strategy.
Well, it may be earlier and specifically targeted toward those individuals that have the more active immune process going on. So both of those things. What this shows is it can have benefit in individuals that otherwise don't respond, and we need to do further randomized control trials to identify the best patients to treat and how best to administer the therapy.
Very good. Finally, let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine. An ongoing issue, one that I think is just really so fascinating. Gosh, we haven't let people who've had cardiac devices have magnetic resonance image scanning. Now it turns out that, for some of those folks, it's probably just fine.
So, Elizabeth, over the past 2 decades, the cardiac devices, the defibrillators and the pacemakers, have been designed to reduce the potential risk associated with MRI. But that doesn't address the fact that there are over 2 million people in the United States, and in fact, 6 million people worldwide, that already have devices that were put in prior to new designs. As a result, as you mentioned, these people are oftentimes told, well, you really can't have an MRI. For concerns, the MRI would either affect the device or cause heating at the tip of the lead where it inserts into the heart. So the question is, well, is that good advice or not? These investigators looked at over 1,000 cases of individuals that either had a pacemaker or defibrillator and had an MRI of some body part other than the chest. And I want to stress that. The MRI wasn't done over the chest area where the device was, but for example, in the abdomen or in the leg or in the joints. And specifically, it was a magnet that was 1.5 Tesla or lower in terms of its intensity. And what they discovered in those 1,000 individuals, there were no adverse effects on the individual or really no adverse effects on the device. Now, the caveat is for the devices, prior to the MRI, they specifically programmed them in a very standard protocol, and then afterwards they interrogated them. And with that, there were essentially no adverse events to the patient or the devices.
I think this is good news. As we're both well aware, MRI is increasingly relied upon for lots and lots of different studies. So it seems like this is a good thing for folks who have these devices.
Yep. In fact, as I mentioned, over the 6 million individuals worldwide, it's estimated that half of them will have some type of clinical indication for having an MRI. With these caveats, it shows that it can be done safely.
Excellent news. On that note, I think I'm going to talk about the stem cell transplantation this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.